Good evening. This is Jenny Gregorio, and this is Health Matters. We air this show once a week to share different topics concerning health with our listeners. And tonight we are going to be talking about art and mental health. So I feel like it's a good time for me to make an announcement for all the art lovers out there. Mona Lisa is now seeking all of our attention. She does not want to share the attention with any of her three roommates that she shares at the Louvre at this time. The Louvre is getting a renovation, and Mona Lisa will have her own room. So I thought this was a great little lead in to our discussion tonight about attention and art and how we perceive art. Today we'll be talking with Chris Fallon about how art and mental health can be a complicated relationship. Chris is currently a psychiatric technician, and he's also a veteran in the Navy. He served 23 years working with the Department of Defense and Behavioral Health and Addiction Medicine. He's also a visual and performing artist and has many things to share about art and mental health, maybe a little contradictory or not intuitive to what we think about as far as art and mental health. We know that art can be a great therapy modality. It's recognized as having beneficial outcomes. And there also can be mood elevation that one can gain just by viewing art. But the goal of tonight's show is to educate our listeners about the continuum of behavior of those who produce art, but also quietly struggle with some trauma, and the complexity of identifying the personal healthy and unhealthy behaviors and reducing the stigma that oftentimes is put on those who struggle. We hope to bring some clarity and some insight about behaviors that seek our attention through art forms, and that if you or someone you know is struggling, that this may encourage them to seek help by a qualified professional. If there's any part of this program that you find interesting that you want to share with others, it will be available on our website or the Red River Radio app. So with all that said, Chris, welcome to the show tonight. We are very excited to have you. How are things there in Norfolk, Virginia?
Well, the weather's good. I live downtown, so you might hear some of the passing cars in the background. If you do, I do apologize for that. So sometimes you'll get an occasional siren or a police car passing by, but I think we'll be okay. Thank you for having me, though. I was really excited to be here. This is a topic that is very close to me on a professional and on a personal level. And I am excited to dive right into it, you know.
So, yeah. Like I said, we're not discussing about art therapy tonight. Tonight's discussion is going to be a little bit more personal and take the form of more of just a conversation how art has been an influence in your life. Because I think you've had a long relationship with art, maybe at times maybe love-hate relationship. I don't know how you would define that relationship. And I wanted to start off with a question for you, just so our listeners can get a little idea about your background. You grew up in an area and during a time when that would not really be considered as having a high access to art exposure, such as like large museums or a focus in the education sector. When and how did art become a focus for you?
Well, it started at a very early age. My father was not what I would consider an artist, but he definitely had some artistic ability. And I just remember it was probably around the age of 5 or 6 years old. He drew, I think it was a superhero out of a cartoon strip, and it completely fascinated me. As a child, it was like watching a magic trick happen. Art is kind of a magic trick. It is an illusion happen. You know, you have an object over here, and then with a series of lines that you compose together, it transforms onto this piece of paper here. So as a child, I was completely fascinated by that. process. And, you know, I quickly asked him to do it over again. And he did that a couple of times. And then he kind of got tired of it. He was like, you know, he didn't want to do it anymore. But I couldn't stop obsessing about it. And so I was determined that I needed to see this happen again. So the only alternative was to make that happen myself. And so with a lot of effort, I would pick up little pieces of cartoon strips out of the newspaper. And I remember the first thing I drew was Dennis the Menace. And I remember very vividly because I apparently drew it well enough to where I brought it to school. I was in the first grade, and immediately the kids started accusing me of tracing. It was that accurate at 6 years old. I think even the teacher implied that I did. I was devastated a little bit by that. But I was also, in my own way, kind of excited about it.
Yeah.
Because I felt like, you know, I drew that well enough to where they thought that I traced it at 6 years old. You know, that was a pretty intoxicating feeling. And at the time, my parents were in the middle of their marriage problems. They were a great set of parents, very loving, and but you know, they had their own struggles going on with their marriage. They were not right for each other, so they were busy with that, and I did not feel seen while all that was going on, because that was taking up a lot of their attention. And I remember my dad seeing that drawing and just being like, "Wow," just taken back, you know, impressed by it. And so it was a way for me to feel seen. I just remember I felt in that moment, that was the first time I just really felt seen. And I also had dyslexia too. So it was the one area in my life I didn't feel like I was failing at. It was the first grade, and I was trying to learn how to read. And I was failing at that. I was failing at math. I was failing at, you know, so this is the one thing I excelled at, and I wanted more of that. So that's kind of where that took off. Sorry, it took a long time to answer that question, but
that's where
it started for me.
Yeah, it shows how the things in our lives just kind of converge. And for a sibling, they don't converge the same, because all the criteria of the DNA or the other nuances or the other things that you are struggling with are not the same. Your siblings may be struggling with something else, or they may have other strengths and weaknesses. And whenever you're trying to get away from the negative of trying to achieve academically, reading, math, the things that dyslexia just completely inhibit. And at that time, there were not many people who knew how to work with children with dyslexia. That makes perfect sense that you would latch on to that.
No, there wasn't. It really was not something that gets talked about enough. You know, I mean, today when we think about learning disabilities that plague kids, generally think of, you know, ADHD and these types of other disorders that you see in children, reactive attachment disorder, conduct disorders, these types of things. But, you don't hear very much about, talk about dyslexia.
I think we're just scratching the surface.
I haven't really kept up with the science on that. Yeah, I think you're probably way more well-versed in that area. I know that that's a topic that
Because it affects me and my family personally. So you tend to gather that information of the things that affect you personally. So how many different forms of art do you practice? Like, I know you're a painter.
It started with visual art at a very early age. I did not get into spoken word for the performing arts until about 12 years ago. It's a complicated story. I'll try to run through it pretty quickly. I was in a relationship with a woman, living with her, and she went to go see her family in Ohio for Thanksgiving. And when she returned, she immediately dumped me. I would later discover pretty briefly after that that she actually went to Ohio to cheat with her ex-boyfriend. So I was devastated.
Yeah.
I was absolutely devastated. And I, at the time, was going to open mics in the area around here where I live. And I always enjoyed listening to spoken word. So, yeah, I mean, I did it as a way to cope with that depression that I sunk into after that that breakup and that the cheating that happened to me. And I was in so much pain that I remember the first time I stood up and I, with poets, they spit a poem. It was in a coffee shop and everything just seemed to stop. I mean, that's not figuratively, that like everything stopped. Like the steam wands on the coffee machine stopped and everybody was just like, and yeah, and the conversation stopped in the coffee shop. And I was hooked, you know, I was really hooked because I had not seen that with the other performers. Uh-huh. And I was sandwiched in between musicians that were playing music and stuff like that. And it's very hard to compete with that when all you have is words to grab people's attention. A little personal information about myself. I also struggle with bipolar disorder. At the time, I was going through what I wouldn't know until much later down the road. I was going through a manic episode. And so in a very short period of time, after finding out that just being on the stage and being in front of people, how intoxicating that was, and that was a few minutes where I didn't experience that pain, I wanted more of that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't care how I got it. So I just dived into every performing art form. I mean, I've done stand-up comedy, I've done music, I was in a band for a while, you know, I've done visual art. So it was just basically a way for me to be seen. That was also what I would also come to learn later on in life, that was also part of a trauma response to abandonment. I was not connecting the dots back then, even though I was working in mental health. I didn't have that insight about myself. But yeah, that was an attempt. That it was just me pretty much repeating the same behavior that I had done as a small child at 6 years old in even more nuanced ways, but still in the arts, just branched out into the performing arts too as well. So,
That's interesting because here I think that a lot of maybe our listeners or a lot of people think that whenever you have the background and the education and you're working in the mental health field, you just don't have mental health issues or you can identify them easily. I think that it's surprising when they say, well, how did you not see or connect these dots? But it's so complex and it happens on such a continuum. And whenever it's you, not your client, it's hard to have that insight, that mirror into yourself. So we oftentimes we think about like art as one of the self-care topics. You know, we hear about clinicians and we talk to our clients about having a self-care plan, having something to take care of yourself. And art, in a lot of ways, seems like it is the perfect self-care, you know? But is that how art works for you? I mean, because here you are saying that you were not recognizing it and you're feeding off of this attention and social aspect. We want people to have that social aspect, but in a healthy way of making relationships. Talk about that.
Yeah, and you know, this is a question that I've struggled with myself. I have mixed feelings when I talk about art as a therapeutic experience for a person or a therapeutic process. I never really see it as, you know, you use the word self-care. I don't really see it as self-care. It's something I've just been doing for so long that it is just something that I need. And there are times when I've often questioned myself and even wondered if this is a healthy endeavor for me to engage in. And a lot of people think that that's odd for me to say that because oftentimes, you know, the assumption is that it's always therapeutic. It's always. And then there are certain ways that it has not always been therapeutic for me. And that's a little bit more of a complex conversation to have. I can talk about that in depth if you want. It is a topic that you could reserve a whole podcast for.
Right.
But I could explain that. I could do use some examples to try to explain that
Let me ask you for maybe if we've got listeners that are trying to understand this, how is it possible to use art in an unhealthy way to fill that void that trauma has created? I mean, what is an example? Because I'm sure you work with a lot of different people, different ages. You've been working with people for a lot of different years. And there's a lot of different defense mechanisms we use to protect ourselves. So how can a person look at something and say, am I using this to fill an unhealthy void? Is something unchecked here? And I don't mean art. I mean, it could be, well, professionally, you know, whether it's work or hobbies or a serious art, whatever, music, however you want to look at it.
Sure. I'll start with your first question there of how, in what ways is art unhealthy? I guess that if I'm understanding your question right. And the simplest way I can probably explain that is I'd have to go back to the original reason why I started making art at a young age. It was to be seen in a family where I felt, where I was experiencing a lot of uncertainty and a lot of neglect because my parents were really busy with their own lives and their work and their relationship problems. So it was a way to be seen. And some people would say, well, you know, what's wrong with that? Then it must have been pretty healthy. But that was always short-lived. Even the artistic expressions that I did later in life that I just told you about, you know, open mics and everything, you know, for that 4 or 5 minutes of time, sure, I felt seen, and it was very intoxicating. And it was, you know, it was a real mood elevator for me. But it was not satisfying the trauma. It would be short-lived. You know, I would ride that high for like a night, and then I would wake up the next morning, and then I would have that feeling again of emptiness, of feeling invisible. And I would need to do that again. And so I would do that again. And I was producing a lot of great work, because when you don't feel seen and you feel invisible or not heard, you're always reaching for the bigger bullhorn. You know, and so it causes you to create some really good work. It can draw, that neurosis can draw some great work out of you, because you will dig deeper. There's nothing more motivating than that. If you feel like you're not seen and you're trying to, you know, you're invisible and you're a ghost walking through life, you know, you will make the loudest bullhorn you can. And that, by that, I mean, use that as a metaphor of the best looking art you can possibly make. It's a great motivator. Mm-hmm. As I said, once the dust settles and the intoxicating high of creating something and then getting recognition for that would settle, and then I'd be right back to feeling that feeling of emptiness, that void. I was on that cycle. I was just on that cycle. And sometimes, and oftentimes, I wondered, and I still to this day, I mean, I know the answer to this, but my time would have been better served learning how to be okay not being seen and being okay with that. That would have been a much, I often question whether or not that would have been a more healthier pursuit for me, even though it bared a lot of fruits, and I have that evidence all over my house. But yeah, so I have mixed feelings about it. You know, has it enriched my life? Has it produced a lot of fruits for me? As I said, to use that metaphor, certainly it has. But did it heal me? No, it did not. But I also don't want to say that art can't be therapeutic too, as well. And I can give some examples of why it is and how it can be in certain ways and stuff like that.
If I'm hearing you correctly, about how being in a place in a crisis or a traumatic with traumatic baggage or a traumatic experience, like maybe our veterans who are struggling when they come home, or say a person who has been in a domestic abuse situation, that can bear a lot of artistic fruit. And we have examples of that from great artists that their works are hanging in the best museums around the globe. There's a lot of trauma hanging on the walls that that we go and admire all the time.
I mean, there is a reason why we have the cliche, you know, the tortured artist. You know, that historically has been a cliche about artists for a long time. You know, that goes back hundreds of years. There was a philosopher I was reading in art history. It was about 400 or 500 years ago. He talked about the four temperaments. Mm-hmm. I don't know, and I can't remember them all, but one of them struck me as interesting, and it was called the melancholic. And it's where the term melancholy works. And for each field of academic study, there was a temperament for. And the one for artists was melancholic, which is where the melancholy, but you know, the word melancholy came from.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how far that goes back. There seems to be some legitimate parallels or connections between artists and mental health problems. And I don't know now, is that correlation or causation? I don't know. That's somebody else could probably tell you that, you know, study that thing. But that struck me as really interesting when I was studying art history.
And this
I wish
seems
I had
to
the
follow,
sources in front of me to kind of.
Yeah, this fit seems to follow just a trove of genre. I mean, you know, like Shakespeare's Divine Comedy. I mean, it's in plays,
yeah.
It's in music, it's in.
Mm-hmm.
And in comedy, a lot of our stand-up comedians have a backstory that is where they're truly they have incredible insight, and they give us incredible comedy, and they pull on these threads of truth, and they bring a different, lighter perspective. And it's like, wow, I mean, what a gift to be able to drill that down and give us this comedy. But it's also a curse in some ways.
Yeah, it is, because when pain and mental health conditions are amused, what happens when you get better? And that was another way that art was sort of unhealthy for me. After the breakup that I experienced that was devastating to me, it produced a lot of great spoken word written stuff, you know. I mean, I mean that in the most objective way that I can. I'm not just saying that. I mean, I was asked to be this guest, you know, spoken word artist at the feature presentation, at feature open mics and stuff like that and everything. So apparently other people seem to agree with me on that. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was producing a lot of good stuff, but it was all coming from that pain. And once I started feeling better, I found that I wasn't able to produce the same quality of work. So I did some pretty unhealthy things to myself just to kind of, you know, keep myself sick. I self-sabotage in ways that, and we'll talk about here, but yeah, I mean, I did some self-sabotaging, not self-harm in the physical sense,
right?
That you think of, you know, like cutting or burning or whatever, but things that weren't so great for my mental health, so I could stay in that state of mind.
That's not
so
uncommon that people do self-sabotage, and that they are unaware of their measures to self-sabotage along the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of people who are afraid of going to the next step of achievement and will self-sabotage. And
yeah.
There's a lot of reasons why we do that as human beings, and probably mm-hmm. rooted in some evolutionary psychology. So as far as art, if you were speaking to a friend who is an artist and they were
mm-hmm.
struggling with some things, would you encourage them to take their art to therapy with them? Do you think that talking about your art has highlighted some of the underlyings of struggles for you. Do you think that that has been helpful for identifying some things for you or not? Maybe it has not. Would you encourage someone to take their art to counseling with them?
Well, I mean, I can think of the most recent time that I brought my art into a therapy session.
Wasn't like the art that is as big as a wall that you were dragging in.
No.
Okay.
No, these were just some sketches that I did. That's what I mean by the bigger bullhorn. You know, that is a perfect example of that, by the way. She's talking about, for the listener, I do these 60 by 72 inch semi-abstract things. But yeah, I mean, the most recent time that I took my art, used it as a therapeutic tool to bring in the work, because I was doing an interesting therapy that is somewhat new. It's an evidence-based therapy. It's called internal family systems. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but
yeah.
It's the idea that when people suffer from a trauma, it's going to sound like the way I talk about it, and I'm not an expert in this subject matter, so I can give you a very rudimentary, elementary, you know, explanation of how it works, but or the idea behind it. It's almost like it treats trauma in very similar ways that you would treat somebody with dissociative identity disorder. It comes from the school of thought that it is way more common when somebody experiences trauma for them to develop that we are not a monocell. This is especially true when somebody experiences trauma. It makes sense that they develop different selves, different personalities to cope with different things in their environment, in their dysfunctional environment. So they have this internal family living within themselves that they rotate through to help them, like a set of golf clubs for each, you know, different, you know, occasion or whatever, you know, that personality, you know, they utilize that.
Which we do on a regular basis. Like you have your work self, your home self.
Right. Exactly. You know, we don't wear the same hats that we do at work. Yeah. So we all have that to some degree. So the idea of internal family systems is that we get into emotional distress when those entities, those personalities inside of ourselves are within conflict with each other. They're not in harmony. So it tries to create an equilibrium with that. I don't know what the word that I'm looking for, you know, if that's the best word. But anyway, the start of that is to identify them. And one of the benefits that you have as being an artist is that, you know, I was able to actually draw these personalities out, you know, and actually confront them and be have them sitting and facing right in front of me, which is something that, you know, not everybody has that ability. So it was an advantage in that area. So that's probably the most recent example I can think of where I actually brought art into, you know, my own personal therapeutic world or whatever. But
well, that is definitely playing to your specific strengths, because I would bring in that blank sheet of paper with a square box and it would be a Piaget moment. And what is this? Well, It's a goat. Well, what do you mean it's a goat? Well, the goat's inside the box, you know? Can't you sit, like, well, the five-year-old explaining what they drew?
I should probably mention, obviously, you know, in some ways it was good, but in some ways it's bad, because when you can draw, it sort of the artist brain kind of kicks in and you start, like, stop thinking about the process. And, you know, whereas if I didn't have that, I would be able to let go of that and just get some raw expressive stuff on paper and leave the artist brain aside. But so it was an advantage, but also a disadvantage in some ways. Like I had a hard time getting out of my way, is basically, so that I could really allow those internal family systems to come out, you know, and put them in front of me and see them, because sometimes they can be really abstract. They can be really abstract, like just a blob or something like that. And when, you know, when you're an artist and you're so used to, you know, doing visual art as a display, you know, you come at it from that viewpoint and you lose something in that. So It was an advantage, but a disadvantage at the same time. But anyway, I'm going on
Well,
too
so
much about that.
I want to move into, for the audience, some different terms that to make sure that we've got some foundation before we move into this next conversation. But whenever we're asked to walk into a room that we're familiar with and something's been added, and if we're asked what's been added, we could probably pretty quickly point that out. But it's different when you walk in and you're asked what is missing. That's a little bit harder to identify. And when we talk about having problems, when people struggle with attachments and or they have unhealthy attachment styles or abandonment, I want to talk about those types of things to the point where we understand that abandonment is not that leave the baby on the doorsteps of the orphanage or the fire station type. There's all types of abandonment and due
Sure.
to just life happening. Maybe maybe the parents have been go through financial struggles, which takes them away for work more, or maybe they've gotten a promotion, which makes them travel more, or maybe there's economic times that totally
Or what we see around
preoccupies.
here, this is military children experience abandonment all the time. And when I worked in pediatric mental health for Fort Eustis, reactive attachment disorder was a very common, we were seeing a lot of that, but yes, yeah, so there's abandonment can come in so many different forms. And it's not, you're right, it's not always a parent, not always as nefarious as a parent, I don't want my kid anymore, and they leave, but kids, they process abandonment. Children, abandonment to them is abandonment. It doesn't matter a whole lot more if it was because dad got deployed, and he didn't really have a choice, or if it's just dad split because, he didn't want to. For a child, I don't know if it's as painful, but for them, they process it the same way. It's at the end of the day, it's the parent that left, and they don't have the ability to completely understand it. And as we know, kids or children are egocentric, so it must be their fault. It must be about them. So yeah, that's the way they process it. And because children are dependent on their parents for all of their needs to survive. It is a threat to their safety. It's a threat to their security. So it is a form of trauma. And I think that that's something that needs to be, it can't be stated enough, because oftentimes when we think about trauma, we think about it in terms of maybe a combat veteran or somebody who was exposed to or the victim of sexual assault or exposed to a natural disaster. So why is it important to draw those similarities? I think it's important because oftentimes we fail so often to have empathy when somebody has a response to abandonment trauma versus somebody having response to something like combat, like I just, if we see a combat veteran and they have a, and their trauma response presents in the following ways. Maybe they have what's called hyperarousal. It's one of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. And it might look like the veteran that you hear about, that the combat veteran that gets really emotionally dysregulated at the sound of fireworks, that would be called an external trigger. And when they are exposed to that, their brain goes back to that traumatic combat experience, and their brain reacts as such, as if it is under fire. And even though it's not, now we all get startled when we hear a loud bang. But if it's on the 4th of July, most of us kind of, we we don't get too alarmed by it because our first assumption is, well, it's 4th of July, so it should be. But in the combat veteran, the brain automatically makes that connection. So most people would not make fun of somebody, you know, experience a combat veteran experiencing something like that. But a person with abandonment trauma would also have that symptom of hyperarousal to an external trigger, but that external trigger might be somebody taking too long to respond to a test. And then the brain automatically makes that traumatic, that abandonment trauma brain makes that connection to that external trigger as, oh my God, this is abandoned. This person is ghosting. They're leaving me, even though that probably not the case, but that becomes their reality and they respond. Yeah.
Do you find that that trigger unconscious, conscious, a mixture of both?
Well, oftentimes they do not make those connections. People who struggle with abandonment trauma or what we call anxious attachment styles, they don't make those connections as they don't even often themselves see it as a response to trauma. They often see it as, oh my God, you know, why am I so needy? Why do I need such reassurance all the time? You know, I'm so stupid, whatever, you know, I'm so weak or whatever.
So then there's
that
self-loathing
about it. Yeah. And then, and that's the tragic part about it. And that's why it's so important to understand that this does not make you weak. It doesn't mean that you're weak or you're needy or you're clinging. You're simply having a trauma response, a response to a trauma. It's just a different type of, it's not a whole lot different from somebody who is having a trauma response to combat or to a sexual assault. This is just a different trauma. And with different traumas, you have different triggers, you know, like a person with abandonment trauma, their trigger is not going to be the sound of a loud bang, you know, or a sexual assault person is going to be different from somebody with abandonment trauma. It may not be, you know, a delayed response to a phone call or somebody showing up late to a date. But once the person starts to think of their behaviors, their neediness behaviors and their clinginess and type of things as a trauma response and not just them just being too clingy. And society doesn't really help a lot with that. I mean, it's still, you know, I remember the example of that, the way society contributes to this stigma. You know, it can even be in our pop culture often. I remember a movie years ago. This is one of my favorite examples to use. It was called The Wedding Crashers. I don't know if you saw that.
Yeah.
There's a scene in there where, you know, this woman forms this obsessive attachment to Vince Vaughn's character. And they actually have a joke about her, like a name, you know, stage 5 clinger. And she became the comic relief of the whole show. Basically, they made a whole comedy out of a trauma response. And most people don't even make that connection. And probably the people who suffer from that probably didn't make that connection. But those are the types of ways that we look at people who have things called like anxious attachment styles, those types of engage in those types of behaviors. We don't have empathy for them.
Right. And those negative stigmas, they have a way of taking a life of their own because I did see the movie, and separately, I have to say, I have heard stage 5 clinger flippantly thrown around. So that stage 5 clinger mm-hmm. type of label takes on a life of its own, and it does further that message. And it's not a message of empathy. Hey, this person's needs are not met. They need some reassurance. They need some. So we don't have the education.
Yeah.
To help us with that.
Right. And you know, and there's a real, it's a tricky thing to talk about because we also need to remember that we can have empathy for these people, but that also doesn't mean that we need to give up our own boundaries.
Right.
I can have empathy for somebody with an anxious attachment style or what we would call borderline personality disorder. When I see them latching on too tightly to me, or whatever, I can acknowledge that and not judge them and everything, but I can also have some respect for my own boundaries and say, it's okay to set boundaries with that person. And we need to remember that their trauma is not, you didn't cause that, and it's not your responsibility to create that. That's not the intent of this, me talking about this, is to say that we need to tolerate if somebody's violating our boundaries and calling us too much or blowing up our phone or throwing rocks at our window or whatever. I'm not making excuses for that. All I'm asking is that we reevaluate how we look at these people and not just look at them as just a character out of Fatal Attraction or something like that.
Right.
You know, like
right.
The negative, the most extreme examples of that, that Hollywood portrays and stuff. Mm-hmm. So yes, your boundaries are still valid and you shouldn't, you know, you don't, it doesn't mean you don't set boundaries with them, but I hope that this talk will help people at least have some more empathy for them. But yeah.
I think identification of unhealthy behaviors is the first step. And then the second step would be, what are we going to do about these behaviors that are negatively impacting myself and my life? How do I want to move forward? So how would you advise someone to move forward? What can they see in their future? What kind of therapy would they seek out for unhealthy attachment styles and abandonment issues? What kind of treatment and where should they start? And what can they expect out of the outcomes?
For a long time, the prognosis for people with this, and now I'm talking about the most severe cases, like borderline personality disorder would be one of the more extreme case of somebody
difficult.
Who suffered from a lot of, which I don't have enough time to go get into. The prognosis for that was very poor for many years, but there's been a lot of evidence-based treatments that have developed that to treat that. One of them is dialectical behavioral therapy, mm-hmm. DBT. There is also internal family systems has shown a lot of promise in treating the IFS model. If you're interested in that, a good book to start with would be a book called No Bad Parts. That's a great book to visit. And then there's a couple of other treatments that have shown some degree of help, and some of them, everybody is different. So right. It's hard to say what will work for them, but acceptance commitment therapy, I'm a big fan of that, ACT. And then the OG of evidence-based treatment, cognitive behavioral therapy. A lot of people are moving a little bit. That has sort of not been moving. There's a trend moving away from that more recently over the years in favor of some of the other ones that I talked about, because some people respond to that very well and some people not so much. And there are good reasons for that, that I don't know if we have time to really talk
about.
I think
that the DBT, the dialectical behavior treatment, has shown promise because I think that its foundation is actually for people who get very caught up on extremes, the blacks and the whites, that it brings them into conversations and awareness of the gray areas so that they're not so focused on extremes, which people with attachment issues or abandonment issues, that anxiety, that panic response goes to an extreme. It's that, you know, those fears, those anxieties kick in. And so I think it helps to calm when it gives them another option, something a little bit more based in reality, or not that what they're experiencing is not reality, but it just tones the conversation in their head down a bit.
Yeah, I will confess, I don't know as much about DBT as I should. I haven't run into too many situations where I've had to use it a lot,
mm-hmm.
but I do know that it combines it. There is a combination of, you know, some cognitive work,
mm-hmm.
challenging that you would see a little bit of some of the stuff that you'd see in cognitive behavior therapy, where you challenge problematic thinking, or the old school word for it was thinking distortions. I think now we're like using unhelpful thinking or whatever has replaced that. But, along with some mindfulness tools and things like that, mm-hmm. that are more meditative and spiritualistic kind of stuff. And there's a good reason for that. The research, when it comes to what psychology tells us, is that if the brain is in a state of, in a relaxed state, then the body cannot be in a state of distress. And so if you relax the brain, the body will follow. But the opposite is true too as well. If the body is in a state of rest, the brain cannot be in a state of distress. So you have two different approaches, you know, the front door and the back door. The front door relaxes the brain and the body follows. The back door, you relax the body and the brain follows. So it makes sense that, you know, that is a good therapy to, you know, for emotional, because emotional lability, what we call with that personality disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, or anxious attachment styles, is a common, you know, thing that they struggle with. So finding tools to help them, you know, regulate those emotions.
That can actually be a mantra for us all, is our goal should be balance. I think that anytime there is a tilt and balance in us, we have dysregulation. So all this stuff is on a continuum, and there is no treatment that is a one size fits all. I mean, you've got to search out, no therapist that fits all. So you've got to search out who, you know, what.
No medication that fits all.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So unfortunately, it's kind of a, you have to put in the work to receive the fruits and the relief that it can give you. We used art as an example, but a lot of different things can be used in an unhealthy manner. So I just wanted to go ahead and put that out there. We're hopefully getting back together and carrying on this conversation for a lot more times, because we only scratched the surface here about attention-seeking behaviors and how we disguise those behaviors and use them as a coping device. So I wanted to thank you for coming on the show and talking about this and sharing some of the personal stories and your clinical knowledge with us about abandonment and unhealthy attachment styles. And hopefully our listeners got some information that they can use, pass along to anybody who may need this, who may need to seek some help for anything that they're struggling with. Do you have anything else that you want to share in closing? We've got just a couple minutes.
No, I mean, I have lots of things that I could talk about this, but I look forward to, and maybe we could have a part two to this discussion, because this is definitely something we could explore. Like, we could really take a deep dive into.
That would be wonderful. I would love to have you back on. Yeah. This is only, like I said,
time passed so fast. It feel like we just scratched the surface.
So we've introduced some terms, and now we're ready to get into it. So we will do that again next time.
I think we set some good foundation, and got some good takeaways.
Thank you for bringing this conversation to the table for us, because I think that it is contrary to how we look at art and our behaviors with art. And I think that was kind of special. I don't think that there are a lot of people that understand the complexities and the nuances that surround art.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so
much.
Okay.
All right.
Health Matters is a program for information purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or your health professional. This show is available for download at redriverradio.org or available at the Red River Radio app. Views expressed on Health Matters may not necessarily express those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or the staff. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. Production assistance was provided tonight by Caden Cox and Kiara Lafitte. Production of Health Matters is made possible in part by the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. Please join us next Thursday for Health Matters. I am Jenny Gregorio, and thank you for joining us this evening.